Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's rejection of the controversial Keystone XL tar sands oil pipeline by the State Department that is bound to become an election year issue. Joining us are Elizabeth McGowan and Lisa Song with InsideClimateNews.org. Elizabeth McGowan covers the US Capitol and environmental politics for Inside Climate News, and Lisa Song writes about the impact of the proposed pipeline on the states it is supposed to cross from the tar sands of Alberta, Canada, to the refineries of Texas. Then we'll look into the contentious appearance of Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orbán before the European Parliament, where he was accused of taking the country on the wrong path towards authoritarian rule. Daniel Kellerman, the Jean Monnet Chair and Director of the Centre for European Studies at Rutgers University, joins us to discuss the right-wing direction of Hungarian politics and efforts by Orbán's ruling party to suppress press freedom, take control of Hungary's judiciary and central bank, and perpetuate their own rule. Then finally, we'll discuss Mitt Romney's tax returns, which the Republican frontrunner appears to be reluctant to release. One of the country's leading experts on taxation and tax law, David K. Johnston, joins us to discuss the growing controversy over Romney's tax returns and the 15% rate that he admits to paying, which drew ridicule from his rival, Newt Gingrich. Joining us now is Elizabeth McGowan and Lisa Song. Elizabeth has been a reporter for more than two decades and has written extensively about the Keystone XL oil sands pipeline for Inside Climate News, a journalism website that does original reporting on energy and environmental issues. She is based in Washington, D.C., and Lisa Song has also written extensively about the Keystone Pipeline for Inside Climate News. She has an article there, "TransCanada, No More Than 6,000 Pipeline Workers on the Job on Any Given Day." Welcome to Background Briefing, Elizabeth McGowan and Lisa Song.
Thank you.
And beginning with you, Elizabeth, since you've been covering Capitol Hill, what are the politics behind this? It seemed like the Republicans thought they'd box the president in with this February the 21st deadline, 2 months to make a decision. The president was in a difficult position with the environmental movement having forced him into delaying the pipeline, largely because of Bill McKibben and 350.org and the demonstrations at the White House. And I think he thought he'd dodged a bullet until the Republicans came back at him. So where do we stand now in this battle?
Well, I think where we stand now is this is an election year, so who knows what might be up people's sleeves. But already the Republicans today have called for a hearing next week where they've invited the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, to speak. And they're going to ask her specifically about the Keystone XL. So what we're seeing is, you're exactly right, you framed it exactly right, is they thought they had boxed the president in, taking two of his, you know, base supporters, the environmental groups and the union and the jobs, and thought, we're going to make him choose. But he had told them, we don't have a sufficient information to make a decision about this pipeline. And so he stood up and said, I'm going to reject it, you know, as it stands now. So it means that this is going to be in the news. This is not going away. This will continue. There will be continued pushing to try to get the president to change his mind somehow, or to try to speed this thing along. I understand that TransCanada can also apply again for another permit for this, you know, same pipeline. So they also have that option, and it would also have to go up for review, just as this one has.
But do you think, though, what Hillary Clinton will say, and what the State Department said today, and what the White House reiterated, is that they could not make such a serious decision on a 2 month time frame, that it was just impossible to do the due diligence necessary, and therefore they had to cancel it? So, do you think that's going to wash, that it's all the Republicans' fault for pushing this thing too fast?
Well, it seems, you know, it's strange, because it does appear that they were trying to wield a cudgel, and it, you know, today it looks like it came back and hit them in the head like a boomerang. And that's how it looks to everybody. But what happened was, I mean, they wanted to speed up this decision because the president had come out in early November, his administration had come out and said, we know you're waiting for this pipeline to be approved. We've run into some debacles, which Lisa can comment on, that they had to reroute it. The people in Nebraska wanted it out of the Ogallala Aquifer and wanted to reroute it. So the president said, look, there's too much. We have to make too many changes here. This has become too much. We didn't know it was going to take this long, but they tried to do their due diligence and said, look, we're not going to be able to approve this thing until early 2013. Well, here in Washington, everything is seen in a two-year or four-year cycle, so that disturbed people because it looked as if it was going to be, or it was going to be, post-2012 presidential election. So that's when the Republicans decided to step in and try to speed it up. So it, you know, no doubt TransCanada wants this thing to pass and had, you know, there was legislation earlier that was written that said, you know, the president has to speed it up and approve this thing. Well, this legislation was you give it a thumbs up or a thumbs down. And he said, look, I don't have sufficient information. I'm giving it a thumbs down. So right now it looks like, you know, the boomerang did hit them. But it's still, this is a topic. Now that he's rejected it, the Republicans are going to keep using it. They're going to say, you know, all of these potential jobs lost, all of this work not being done, you know, the unemployment rate is at 8.5%. Why is the president turning his back, basically, on something that they see as something that can provide jobs, provide work, provide infrastructure, provide energy security, all those arguments that they've been making in favor of this pipeline all along.
Well, let's turn to Lisa Song, who's written extensively about the impact of the Keystone Pipeline on the states it would cross. She has an article at Inside Climate News, TransCanada, no more than 6,000 pipeline workers on the job on any given day. That flies in the face of what the oil companies were saying, right? The lobbyists for the oil companies were saying that there's 20,000 jobs involved.
What happened with that was TransCanada has been saying for years the pipeline would create 20,000 jobs, and they came out with a press release last week saying 7,000 of those jobs would be in manufacturing and another 13,000 in direct construction jobs. But if you look at the numbers, a lot of those jobs are temporary, and it's also there's a lot of confusion over what counts as a job, because you could have one person working on a job for 2 years or two people working at that same job for 1 year each. And so in that case, do you count it as one job or two? And that means that the job numbers can be spun in somehow to make it appear like there are more jobs than there will be. And last week, a TransCanada spokesman told me that there would be 13,000 construction jobs, but only 6,000 people would be working at any given time, up to 6,000 people. And so that's just added to the confusion over the jobs numbers. And the U.S. State Department has a report out saying the project would require 5,000 to 6,000 construction workers. And there's a different report from Cornell University that basically has those same numbers.
Well, I spoke during the Iowa caucuses to a Huffington Post reporter who had been covering the candidates, and she was also covering the voters. And she told me that universally the voters in Iowa were really upset, and these are Republican voters, about the Keystone issue, and that it appeared to be working as a Republican wedge issue, that they really felt that this was a key issue that showed that Obama didn't care about jobs and didn't care about getting us free from foreign oil. So how do you think it's going to play, the rejection of this pipeline, if you've been to these areas that where the pipeline would go?
Well, I've talked with a lot of landowners in Nebraska and South Dakota, and these are the people who would be affected the most if the pipeline is approved, because the pipeline would literally pass through their backyards. And these, most of them are farmers and ranchers. They live in very rural areas of the state. And their biggest worry is that an oil spill from the pipeline would contaminate their water and land. You know, the water and land is what matters most to them. It's how they make their living. So in their case, they don't want the pipeline because it could endanger their livelihoods. It's not about politics for them. It's just about what they know and what they do on a day-to-day basis.
And what compensation would they get? Because a pipeline across your land is not only a scar on the land, I imagine it affects cattle, etc. I mean, what's the inducement? Or do they have no choice?
Well, they would get paid some amount of money for allowing the company to bury the pipeline on their land, and those negotiations are secret, so we don't really know how much money they would get. But also, the company is allowed to use eminent domain. So basically, if the company and the landowner can't reach an agreement over how much money they'd get, the company can take the landowners to eminent domain court and have the court determine the right amount of compensation. And that leaves the landowners with not much choice.
So, Elizabeth McGowan, the Keystone people are already talking about reapplying. The Canadian Prime Minister apparently was informed by President Obama, who considers him a friend, although he was extremely disappointed, to put it mildly. And Stephen Harper's Natural Resource Minister, Joe Oliver, basically says, well, you know, we're going to diversify and expand our markets, including the growing Asian market. So I guess the implication is there, if this doesn't go through, they'll send a pipeline from the oil sands to the coast, Pacific coast, and ship the oil to China.
Well, I mean, that is the conversation, and that's what, you know, happened down here in the States, is that it was turned into an sort of an us versus them. If we don't accept this pipeline, then the TransCanada, as well as other companies that are mining the oil sands in Alberta, Canada, would go west and open themselves up to the Asian markets. The thing is, there are some holdups there because they have to go through British Columbia to get a lot of that oil out of there, and that is the indigenous people and other environmental organizations and other landowners in British Columbia are not too keen on this idea. So there is a lot of pushback there. So how that will evolve, that's an enormous question, but it is something that is on the top of everybody's mind, because I think the last thing Canada wants to have is have that enormous energy resource trapped in Alberta. I mean, they want to get that out, and they're looking for ways to get it out. So this is a big blow if the Keystone XL is not built. You know, they are shipping oil sands down here via the original Keystone route, and this Keystone XL would be an extension of it. But you know, you talk to the energy experts, and they say one way or another, this oil will get out and go be exported somewhere, because we are such an energy-hungry world.
But tell me, though, because I've spoken to Bill McKibben a few times, and he led the demonstrations at the White House that essentially, I think, forced the White House's hand to delay a decision. Bill McKibben came out today and said this isn't just the right call, it's a brave call. He also said that the president's going to face a naked political threat from big oil to exact huge political consequences in this election year. I think it's pretty fair to pretty reasonable to guess that the oil companies are going to spend an awful lot of money to defeat Obama. They probably would have done that at any rate. But what about what that means, though, to the environment in Canada? Because not enough is said about how destructive this oil sands process is to the environment where it's extracted and how much water is used and how mm-hmm. billions and billions of gallons of water are being sitting in these huge brackish ponds that grow and grow and grow in size. And that if, at the end of the day, we may rue the loss of all this water. So give us a sense of why that's not getting through in the argument. Are we just that energy hungry that we don't understand the trade-off?
Yeah, I think it's the water, and it's also, I mean, one of the reasons that Bill McKibben was able to turn this into something, and he's the first one to tell you he won't take sole responsibility for it, is making this an issue about climate. The climate movement in the United States had really petered out after certain legislation in the Congress died. They couldn't find their way north. They didn't have an issue. And they took this Keystone XL pipeline because you're exactly right. Extracting it it's an incredibly carbon-intensive mining process. And that's what they latched onto. And that resonated with lots of people. And it wasn't just, you know, the old traditional environmental movement. It attracted a huge swath of people who had voted for Obama in 2008 and were disappointed in him, and that riled them up, and they came to Washington, they got arrested in front of the White House, and they made that their signature issue, is talking about, as Jim Hansen, the NASA scientist, refers to it as, you know, if this all of these oil sands are harvested, it will be a carbon bomb. And in his opinion, it's game over on trying to control greenhouse gases. So that did come to light, and it did catch Obama's ear and put him on the spot because he was afraid he was going to lose support from those environmentalists. So,
well, just in the last minute, let me ask Lisa Song about the implication of the jobs that your work. Lisa says that only 6,000 pipeline workers are on the job any day. That's a quote from the TransCanada company itself. What about that as a political issue in this election year? The jobs issue. Do you think they're going to be? Is there going to be any pushback on that? Because it obviously is resonating with the Republican voters.
Well, I think that there was a big advertising campaign launched recently, supported by the American Petroleum Institute and others who support the pipeline, all pushing the jobs numbers, and they were quoting TransCanada's 20,000 jobs. But I've also spoken with one of the unions, Laborers International, that supports the pipeline, and what their spokeswoman told me was they're not worried about how many jobs in total the pipeline would bring. They're supporting the pipeline because they know it will create some jobs, and it will make a difference to individual union workers who get those jobs. So I think there's a range of how people are using the jobs for political purposes.
Well, I thank both of you for joining us here today, Elizabeth McGowan and Lisa Song.
All right, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Elizabeth McGowan and Lisa Song. Elizabeth has been a reporter for more than two decades and has written extensively about the Keystone XL oil sands pipeline for Inside Climate News, a journalism website that does original reporting on energy and environmental issues, and she's based in Washington, D.C. And Lisa Song has also written extensively about the Keystone Pipeline for Inside Climate News. She has an article there, TransCanada, no more than 6,000 pipeline workers on the job on any given day. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the emergence of fascism in Europe.
Someone's at nine. I'm a real. I'm a real.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Daniel Kellerman, the Jean Monnet Chair and Director of the Center for European Studies and a Professor of Political Science at Rutgers University. He's the author of Eurolegalism, the Transformation of Law and Regulation in the European Union, and The Rules of Federalism, Institutions and Regulatory Politics in the EU and Beyond. He serves on the editorial boards of the Journal of European Public Policy and West European Politics, and is a former member of the Executive Committee of the European Union Studies Association. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Kellerman.
Thanks for having me.
And the Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban appeared before a very skeptical European Parliament, defending his efforts to change the laws in regard to Hungarian Central Bank and the judiciary. And of course, prior to this, he had a pretty rough time before the European Parliament over his efforts to take over the press, or at least create new press rules. Where does this stand in terms of a perception or reality vis-a-vis Hungary's drift to the right?
Well, I think the reality is, in fact, very worrying. Orban's party, Fidesz, has a more than two-thirds majority in the parliament, which is the majority necessary to change the constitution, and that's what they did. They wrote a new constitution for themselves that entrenches their power. They've also passed well over 300 laws since coming into power last year, many of which have taken the form of what they call cardinal laws, which are laws that can only be changed by a two-thirds majority. So, you know, therefore, they're entrenching the policies they want for the future, and they're also changing the institutions of Hungarian democracy and eliminating the independence of independent institutions like the central bank, the Supreme Court, in a way that's very worrying. We see a real consolidation of power in Orban's hands.
And just before we get to the judiciary and the bank issues that Orban was under fire for before the European Parliament, what happened over his efforts to control the press?
Well, what happened there was this was one of the earlier laws he had enacted even before this new constitution came into effect. He introduced a media law that put in place a host of changes, among which was a new media regulator that was going to be an appointee of his, so a party loyalist of his, that had enormous powers, both over the allocation of sort of the spectrum, so to speak, so you know, the licensing of stations and de-licensing of stations, various other restrictions where people can submit complaints about biased coverage and that sort of thing by media organizations, and then this regulator has the power to impose very large sanctions on them. So that obviously has a big chilling effect, potentially. So the outcome of that essentially was that the EU last year identified a few of the what they saw as the most problematic elements of the media law, where it really ran afoul of EU laws and regulations. Orban, despite initially saying he wouldn't change a thing, he did back down, made a few changes to come into compliance with what the EU asked, but I'd say he hasn't come into compliance with the spirit of their demands. And so, in fact, just an example of this is just recently, in the last couple weeks, it was the media regulator denied the license to one of what is viewed in Hungary as the last really independent, critical voices in radio. This radio station was denied a renewal for no apparent reason.
Well, apparently, Orban's trying to dismiss all this as technical complaints, but many European parliamentarians say, no, it goes much further. And the EU Commission President, José Manuel Barroso, said that beyond the legal aspects, some concerns have been expressed regarding the quality of democracy in Hungary, its political culture, the relations between government and opposition, and between the state and civil society. So that's pretty much putting him on notice, isn't it?
It sure is. And I think the challenge the EU has is that the way the EU deals with countries who violate EU laws and norms generally is a very legalistic way, right? You have this variety of legal proceedings, but essentially the European Commission, which is the executive arm, can bring a legal action against a member state for violating EU law, and it all is gets very technical and legalistic. And that's part of what the commission has announced today, is that it was launching what they call these infringement proceedings or these legal proceedings against Hungary on three specific issues, having to do with the central bank, having to do with retirement ages of judges, which were changed, and the other one having to do with the data protection authority. But as you said, beyond that, what Barroso, the president of the commission, said in this statement was, look, we want to think, you know, beyond this, you know, legal detailed stuff, that there is an erosion of democracy. Now, the EU isn't very used to dealing with undemocratic member states, right? So this is a real challenge. There is more they could do. Some of the members of the European Parliament on the left, from the Green parties and the Socialist parties, are calling for the EU to potentially suspend Hungary's voting rights under another provision of the EU treaties, you know, that requires member states to maintain democracy and that sort of thing, EU norms concerning human rights, those sort of things. So, you know, potentially, if this does keep going and the conflict keeps escalating, you could see even stronger sanctions against Hungary.
Again, I'm speaking with Daniel Kellerman, who's the Jean Monnet Chair and Director of the Center for European Studies and a Professor of Political Science at Rutgers University. He serves on the editorial boards of the Journal of European Public Policy and West European Politics, and is a former member of the Executive Committee of the European Union Studies Association. And we're talking about the drift to right in Hungary and the extent to which the European Parliament are calling Hungary's Prime Minister, Viktor Orbán, out on this. Of course, the Europeans have considerable leverage, don't they, because of Hungary's extraordinary debt. I believe it's something like 80% of GDP, isn't it? And a lot of that money is owed to Austrian banks, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it is. Hungary right now is in the midst of these negotiations with the IMF, and the IMF has made it clear that it's not going to do anything to help them until it gets a kind of stamp of approval from the EU. So this, in addition to the normal sort of legal tools and threats that the EU can make against states that are violating laws, in this case they have this enormous leverage because Hungary is having a very hard time going to, you know, borrowing on international markets. Their bonds are, you know, facing very high yields, and so that gives the EU great leverage. Yeah.
And they're asking, Hungary's asking for a standby loan from the IMF of 20 billion euros.
Yeah, essentially they're looking forward, thinking they may need a sort of another bailout package, but in the meantime they want a sort of immediate standby loan that will enable them to go to the to the international markets to borrow. But even that is sort of on hold pending, you know, resolution of these tensions with the EU. In particular, from the IMF's perspective, their main concern is with the issues surrounding the independence of the central bank, right? But more broadly, the drift toward authoritarianism in Hungary, I think, has everyone worried about what that's going to mean for the economy going forward.
So what is going on then with the data protection authority that the European Union are concerned that this new Hungarian government is trying to take charge of? What does that mean? It sounds a little Orwellian.
Well, yeah. First, I have to say, of the, you know, the different policies, this is one of the ones that I don't know as much about. So I should just say that first. But essentially, what it boils down to is that the Hungarian government has given itself, in the view of the EU, too much power to monitor people's data, you know, in the form of telecommunications, internet, that sort of thing. But more generally, what we see across all these areas, like the earlier conflict last year about the media regulator, now the data protection regulator, the central bank, is that you had a number of institutions, regulatory bodies, or the central bank in Hungary that were supposed to be independent to some extent, right? And in all those cases, what we've seen is that Fidesz is trying, that's Orban's party, is trying to extend its control such that it can put partisan affiliates of its in charge of these institutions and, you know, to end their independence.
So let's go back a little, Daniel Kellerman, again, the Jean Monnet Chair and Director of the Center for European Studies and a Professor of Political Science at Rutgers University. to the predecessors, because there had to be a reason why Orban's Fidesz party won a two-thirds majority, giving it more power than any other Hungarian government had had since the collapse of communism in 1989.
Yeah, well, what happened, there was a socialist government in place, you know, prior to that, and there was this huge scandal where there was a tape recording made, actually, of the socialist prime minister basically speaking to members of his government and saying, sort of admitting to them, well, we've been lying to the voters from morning till night, you know, dawn till dusk, having to, and when he said lying, he was referring to not coming to terms or being honest with voters about the severity of the economic situation facing Hungary, the fact that they were piling up unsustainable levels of debt and that sort of thing. But anyway, when this recording was released, you know, there was a huge firestorm about that. And, you know, in addition, Hungary was having plenty of economic problems. But so in reaction to that, he stepped down. Then there was a caretaker government in place that actually did a lot and negotiated a loan with the IMF and made a lot of progress in Hungary. That was a government under Gordon Bainai. But he had pledged when he took over that he was only going to sort of act in a caretaker role and not stay beyond 1 year. And he stuck to that pledge. And so then when the new election did happen, Fidesz really swept to power. But, you know, essentially what you have now, the situation in the wake of that, is that the left in Hungary is very divided. And you know, there's no strong unified political force on the left. On the right, you have Fidesz, which is you're very dominant, and then further to the right of Fidesz, you have this sort of neo-fascist party called Jobbik, which you know, is another big concern.
So, Daniel Kellerman, just leaking a private recording, of course, raises one's antenna about the secret police. What's the relationship with this government and the secret police, which, of course, pretty much ruled Hungary during the communist period, and then prior to, of course, the communist period, Hungary also had a fascist government.
Well, I honestly don't know much about that or the role of you know, secret police, anything like that. I don't think that's the real heart of the issue or the problem right now in Hungary. I mean, more of what we see happening. I mean, there is some intimidation. For instance, just around Christmas time, members of the opposition were stepped out of parliament as the Fidesz party was passing this, you know, slew of legislation, in particular when they were passing the new election law, which would perpetuate their power. And members of the opposition went outside of parliament and staged a very vocal protest. And a number of them were arrested temporarily or detained, not by secret police, but just by the regular police, because I guess they were, you know, violating rules about how close to parliament you could protest or something. But anyway, this, you know, again, underlined people's fears, you know, where you see members of the opposition being sort of rounded up, but they were all released shortly thereafter. But I think, you know, just back to sort of what you were raising, the specter of what we need to fear here, I think the real danger in what we're seeing is that we have a party which it won through a legitimate, free and fair election. I don't think there's any question there, but it managed to win this massive majority of seats in parliament, and it's now leveraging that to extend its power over as many aspects, you know, of the political system and society as it can, and to put in place reforms that will perpetuate its power for years and years to come.
Well, that's exactly what Putin did with United Russia in Russia.
Oh, yeah, I think there's a comparison, and it's a bit of an irony because Orban has always been very critical of Russia. He entered politics in, you know, the period of democratic sort of transition in Hungary, and, you know, even under communism, as someone who was critical of the then Soviet Union and calling for Hungarian independence, etc. So he has this strong anti-Russian background. But the irony then is that he's using techniques of Putin. He's sort of a Putin light. Or a mini Putin.
So when the former Belgian Prime Minister and the leader of the Franco-German Green Party, Daniel Cohn-Bendit, say to Mr. Orban before the European Parliament that many Hungarians, and this is what Cohen Bennett said, many Hungarians, including Jews and other minorities, are afraid because of Fidesz's policy, and minorities have a right not to live in fear. Because I have to get a little clarity on this. I heard a BBC report about how a lot of young Hungarians are emigrating, that gays are being beaten up on the street, and that gypsies are by these sort of gangs of thugs that seem empowered by the government and the move to the right.
Well, yeah, I think there is a political climate that's developing, and that's not just from Fidesz or Orban's party, but as I said, there's this Jobbik party, this sort of far-right neo-fascist party that has a lot of support. So there's a political climate that is hostile to all those kind of groups you mentioned. And even in the new constitution that Fidesz passed, you know, it has a lot of sort of language, you know, for instance, on marriage. It has language on that. It doesn't include protections for people against discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, things like that. So the whole tone that he is fostering is one that I could see creating fear amongst those vulnerable minority groups. And, I mean, another area where that comes up, something you haven't mentioned yet, was the law on religion, which has been another big controversy where Fidesz passed a law on religious organizations, basically saying that there were some 300-some-odd registered religious organizations in Hungary previously, and they've reduced that initially to 14 religious denominations that are recognized by the Hungarian government and given an official status. And then they've told other religious denominations or religions that they need to apply to Hungary, the Hungarian government, and to meet certain criteria in order to be recognized as an official religious organization. And that obviously has important implications in terms of your tax status, you know, in terms of just your existence as a sort of legal entity. And, I mean, this includes, you know, things like Hindus, Buddhists, Muslims. None of those are now among the 14 officially registered religions, so they all have to sort of apply to be recognized.
Well, just in closing, perhaps changing the subject somewhat, but still connected, and that is that there's a lot of distress in Europe over the euro, and the inability appears to be an extraordinary long time inability on the part of the European authorities to get their hands around the euro crisis. There's a fear on the part of some people that if there's a crash of the euro, then you will have more right-wing parties, echoes of Weimar Germany. Is there any? Do you have any idea of why it is that the Europeans haven't been able to get their hands on this euro crisis?
Let me say a couple things about that. I mean, first, in the context of this broader crisis and just connecting it with what's going on in Hungary, one thing I would say to start out is, you know, although it's been incredibly frustrating how long it's taken European leaders to address the crisis, how they've done it in a piecemeal fashion where each step has been inadequate and they've had to go back again and again to the drawing board. So it's been very frustrating. That being said, I think the conflict with Hungary sort of reminds us of one of the many reasons why we should be lucky we have the EU as an organization in Europe, that although the EU has trouble dealing with a government like Hungary, at least it's there to try to rein in, you know, the excesses of a government like Orbán's.
Well, just in the last minute, do you think it's the euro is going to survive, and the EU that you're a student of, is it going to survive?
Yes, I think both the EU and the euro will survive. I think they've been declared dead or nearly dead before many times, the EU has, only to disappoint, you know, the skeptics. And with the euro, I would say it's not totally impossible that a state, let's say Greece, would leave. I don't think they will leave the euro, but it's not impossible. But the idea that the entire euro currency would collapse, cease to exist, that I think is completely impossible. And we've got to remember this is the second reserve currency in the world after the dollar. The EU, the eurozone, is the second largest economy in the world after the U.S. if you treat it as a collective entity. So, you know, the EU is too big to fail.
Well, on that note, I thank you for joining us, Daniel Kellerman.
All right, thanks very much for having me. My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Daniel Kellerman, the Jean Monnet Chair and Director of the Center for European Studies and a Professor of Political Science at Rutgers University. He's the author of Eurolegalism, the Transformation of Law and Regulation in the European Union, and The Rules of Federalism, Institutions and Regulatory Policies in the EU and Beyond. He serves on the editorial boards of the Journal of European Public Policy and West European Politics and is a former member of the Executive Committee of the European Union Studies Association. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about Mitt Romney's problems with his taxes. All that dying and dust, blowing up your hopes, flamboyant obstacles, oh, deals made to cope, ideas in decline, rise of the loss, yeah, 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 hey, here we stand, slave to networks, master plans, swags the brand, open a can, chains are still, y'all never ran, but the taxman's taken all my dough and left me in my stately home, blazing on a sunny afternoon, and I can't sail my yacht, he's taken everything I got, all I've got's this sunny afternoon. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David K. Johnston, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, formerly with The New York Times. He teaches at the Syracuse University College of Law and writes columns for Tax Notes and The Nation, and has uncovered so many tax dodges that he's been called the de facto chief tax enforcement officer of the United States. He's the author of the best-selling books Perfectly Legal and Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. Welcome to Background Briefing, David K. Johnston.
Well, Ian, thank you. I do need to update you. I don't work for Tax Notes of the Nation anymore. I write for Reuters.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well,
I'm there, a global tax and economics columnist.
So I imagine you're writing about Mitt Romney because
indeed.
I'm astounded at what Mitt Romney said the other day. He sort of shot himself twice in the foot. He said he's been dancing around the question of his taxes for some time. And that he intended to release his tax returns. He was asked about it at the debate, but then he shot himself twice in the foot by announcing that he had paid closer to the 15% rate in taxes, at the same time downplaying the $374,327 in speaking fees that he got in 1 year as not much.
Right.
Do you think he's going to continue to be haunted by this tax issue?
Yes, I think that he's got a serious image problem here, and let me walk through a bit of this. You know, Romney is a very wealthy man. By his own campaign's account, he's worth somewhere between $190 and $250 million. And on top of that, he set up a $100 million trust fund for his five sons, $20 million each. But here's how Romney's different than you and me and most people. We work for somebody, and we get compensated for our services, typically called wages or salary, and the government requires that the taxes be taken out of our check before we get our money. Romney was compensated for managing other people's money at Bain Capital Management, which he was one of the co-founders of, and where he was clearly very good at what he was supposed to do. His compensation, however, wasn't taxed when he got it. It's called carried interest. And he gets this money. He gets to enjoy what flows from it, dividends and interest, and yet doesn't have to pay taxes on it so long as he doesn't sell it and the deal doesn't close. Now, we don't know how much of his carried interest continues to be untaxed. We do know that Bain Capital has huge amounts of money, as Reuters reported earlier, in the Cayman Islands, Bermuda, Hong Kong, Ireland, all of which are depending on the deal, tax havens. The U.S. can actually be a tax haven if you live in another country. And that's what's different, that you and I have to pay our taxes before we get paid. Romney is in this special class of people who they get to get paid now and pay their taxes by and by.
And you reported earlier, David K. Johnson, for Reuters that Bain had held accounts harbored in places such as Bermuda, Ireland, and Hong Kong, but ABC
colleagues of mine did that, not right. me. Yes.
Well, okay, but the ABC News is now reporting that Bain holds up to 138 shrouded offshore funds in the Cayman Islands alone. But ABC News is also reporting that Mitt Romney holds millions of dollars in offshore investments, he holds around $8 million of his personal wealth in as many as 12 funds based in the Cayman Islands. And Romney also lists a separate investment value between $5 million and $25 million placed in the Cayman Islands as well.
Right. And these are all from his disclosure statements. And it's important, Ian, to understand everything that he's doing is perfectly legal. In fact, if we had a full accounting, we would find that he probably gives, as his father did, around 20% of his income to charity, most of it to his church, but a fair amount to other charities. So in some ways, he's a model citizen. But the scandal, the real scandal here is, first of all, that the law allows this. And the law allows this because Joe Sixpack doesn't have a voice in Washington, but the hedge fund managers and the private equity managers do. And they have gotten this special deal, and they've protected it. As it's very valuable to them. I mean, wouldn't you imagine how well off you'd be if for the last 20 years, instead of paying taxes, you'd been able to invest all your income taxes, collect the dividends off of that investment, and only now would you start actually turning the money over to pay the government. You'd be much better off. The country, if we all did that, of course, would be a disaster.
Well, but in response to the ABC News, Andrea Saul, who's a spokesperson for the Romney campaign, says that ABC is flat wrong. The Romney investments in funds established in the Cayman Islands are taxed in the very same way they would be if those funds were established in the United States. That leads you to ask the obvious question, well, why the hell are you putting them in the Cayman Islands?
and the reason for that's very simple. You put these funds, first of all, understand money, there's no money in the Cayman Islands, okay?
So
all
it's just
in the Cayman Islands is a piece of paper that says this money is owned in the Cayman Islands. The money's all in New York and San Francisco and Los Angeles. It's here in this country, but its ownership paper is in the Cayman Islands. It's as if the house that you live in is owned by your father who lives in Montana, and the title to that house is in his bank vault in Montana. Understand that distinction. The reason you do these things offshore is that the people who invest with you, if they are pension funds, including all sorts of private funds, if they are endowments like the Harvard Endowment, the only way that they can get a tax advantage is by being offshore, because nonprofits are not allowed to borrow money to invest in the market unless they pay taxes on their gains. But if they do it through what is nominally in the Cayman Islands, they get to borrow money, invest the borrowed money, and not pay taxes.
Well, my understanding, David K. Johnston, again, the Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, formerly with the New York Times and now with Reuters, the author of Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. My understanding is that the government loses an estimated $100 billion a year because of these tax havens like the Cayman Islands. And it's worth noting that the Republicans who go to the mat for the millionaires and billionaires and will hold up the entire government, they'll hold it hostage to the full faith and credit of the United States to get their way, as they did recently, in order to protect the privileges of the 1%. That's pretty clearly on the record.
Absolutely, and the Democrats are doing it too.
I understand
that. The number one defender of this is Chuck Schumer, followed by Charlie Rangel, both New York Democrats. So, you know, both parties are in this up to their eyeballs.
Well, that is true, but I think, isn't it true now that the Republicans in the House are pushing through a budget cut at the IRS, which would cut the amount of people that would oversee who pays their taxes and therefore weaken the revenue gatherers? And these are people who are supposed to care about the deficit. That's what I'm getting at.
That's right. My column yesterday at Reuters is about the fact that President Obama, bowing to the Republicans, has proposed a real inflation-adjusted 5% cut at the IRS. Now, the senior auditors at the IRS, the ones who do big international companies, you know, General Electric, all the household brand names you know about, for every hour that they audit, they bring in $9,354. So we pay them, the absolute max they can make is about $140,000 a year. Most of them make less than $100,000 a year. And they bring in $19 million and change for a year's work. Why would you not hire more people like that? Well, because if you believe that these corporations are being oppressed by the tax system and you hate government and want to shrink government, then you're going to do that. The problem with that is it's not fair. You and I and everybody else who has a salaried job, we are thoroughly taxed by our Congress. But Congress is shutting down, as much as it can get away with, enforcement of the law against those people who are sophisticated, big, and the biggest corporations. That's not fair. I mean, imagine if the LAPD announced a policy tomorrow that they're only going to ticket people who drive foreign-made cars. We'd all recognize that's an outrage. Well, why don't we recognize that about how Congress funds the IRS?
Well, it should be pretty clear, surely, David K. Johnston, that the government is owned by the millionaires and billionaires, because it's just impossible to get rid of the Bush tax cuts. That was the point I was making. They'll go to the mat for that.
But Ian, the only reason it's owned by those people is that too many of us are busy watching reruns of Law and Order and Dancing with the Stars, and we've outsourced our citizenship.
Good point.
That is the center of this, is that people are, you know, why would I vote? You know, why would I register to vote? Well, you know, this is why. This is the government you get. And you get politicians in both parties. I mean, some of the most egregious tax policy in America comes through Feinstein and Boxer, who are Democrats, and things that they have supported and proposed. And the reason is, we know the rich have access that we don't have. They're donors. They have corporate jets to fly people. The companies have corporate jets to fly congressmen around. They have jobs for family members. You know, if people just organized and voted, we'd have a different Congress.
Well, but they may vote for Mitt Romney, who's one of the 1%. I mean, that's the part that's amazing. He's likely to be the nominee.
What now you're arguing against democracy, Ian. I mean,
no, I'm not.
You know,
I'm not arguing against democracy, by the way. I'm saying by default, if the disaffected Democrats don't vote, this guy will walk in.
Absolutely, yes.
And that's the point I'm making. And by the way, just to get back to him, do you think this? You know, his father released 12 years of tax returns. Everybody releases their tax returns going back many, many years. He's trying to get around it by saying, "I'll just release this year's taxes, and I won't do it until April." So it gives him time to jiggle it around to make it look like. I mean, this is a guy that's worth a quarter of $1 billion. So how's he going to look like the everyman?
Romney. Well, he's not going to ever look like the everyman, but Romney has been running for president now for 5 years. Remember, he tried to get the nomination in 2008, and he was running in 2007, and he filed disclosure forms. So he's had 5 years to orchestrate his finances so that his tax return would look as good as possible in terms of his running for office. But I don't care about his current tax return. The tax returns we want to see are from 1984, when he co-founded Bain Capital Management, until 2000, the year after he left. Those are the ones that matter. And Romney has a real problem here, because when assuming he releases his 2011 return, all it's going to do is lead to more and more questions. And Governor Christie in New Jersey today was on national TV saying, you know, just get it out of the way. I release every one of my tax returns. George W. Bush released his tax returns for every year he had significant income. So did Obama. And when his father, Mitt Romney's father, George Romney, released his tax returns in 1968 when he was trying to get the nomination and he lost to Richard Nixon, he released 12 years of them. And he said, why? Because it was the right thing to do. And what did we find out a few years later in Watergate? That our president, Richard Nixon, had filed 4 years of fraudulent tax returns, criminally fraudulent returns, and I can say criminally because two of his tax advisors were indicted, and those tax returns are listed in the Nixon bill of impeachment. Well, Romney, my guess is Romney has done everything in a perfectly legal way, but we do not really know what's going on unless he gives us all those returns. And I don't mean the 1040, I mean the complete tax return, which in his case probably runs 100 to 200 pages from 1984 through at least 2000.
Well, David K. Johnston, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with David K. Johnston, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, formerly with The New York Times, who teaches at the Syracuse University's College of Law and writes for Reuters. He's uncovered so many tax dodges that he's been called the de facto chief tax enforcement officer in the United States. He's the author of the best-selling books Perfectly Legal and Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. So what do we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we started out with two reporters from InsideClimateNews.org, Elizabeth McGowan and Lisa Song. Today, the State Department rejected the application for the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline that would cross from the tar sands of Alberta all the way down to the refineries in Texas. This has been a contentious issue that Bill McKibben of 350.org shamed the White House into canceling it. They tried to punt it, kick the can down the road. The Republicans came back, tried to make a political issue out of it and embarrass him. It looks like he may have turned the tables on them. Of course, the Canadians will come back with another application. They'll probably go ahead and try and build their pipeline to the Pacific coast to sell the oil to China, and the Republicans will make a lot of hay about it in this election year. You better believe it. And then we talked about how fascism is emerging in Hungary with a right-wing party that's grabbing power just as Putin has done in Russia. Got a very good briefing from Daniel Kellerman at Rutgers, who studies the European Union. They tried to hold the Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban to account for what he's doing. They got some leverage, obviously, because Hungary, like a lot of countries, is broke. Then we talked with David K. Johnston, the leading expert on taxes in the country, about Mitt Romney's taxes, how much he's hiding offshore in the Caymans. That's information is coming out. And just the general disgrace that he only pays 15%, where the rest of us paid so much more. And also interesting to note that the Republicans are going to, and apparently Obama's agreed to it, to cut the amount of enforcement in the IRS to collect money, which makes a mockery of this idea that we have this deficit we have to deal with, because that's the best way to get money to pay off the bills, is to have the IRS collect what's owed to them. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared by half.